Okay, I guess we're ready, right?
Yes.
You got them all
yes.
right? Okay. Okay, sorry about that. Illuminate will be not missed, I presume, by the time this is all over. All right. Carolyn Kim and I would like to share our Phase 1 findings based on a study begun early in 2010 to investigate the use of modified formal debate in our Nursing 609 course called Advanced Trends and Issues in Nursing. I need to underline that this is a work in progress being undertaken by the three of us at a distance from each other, Kim in Vancouver, Carolyn in Winnipeg, and myself here in the Edmonton area. And what I'm presenting today is based on analysis of the data set to date. Phase 2 analysis is well underway, but these findings are not yet ready for presentation. I will not cover in the discussion section much detail, as this is still under development as we refine our analysis further. We anticipate that by June our analysis will be completed, so stay tuned. I'd like to acknowledge the Academic Research Fund from AU and our two research assistants, Rebecca House and Brenda Saline. In terms of background, the course, information about the actual course, Nursing 609. Nurses are challenged by issues that they confront in practice. Position on issues are often based in opinion and past practice rather than on fact. Classroom debates have been found helpful in delivering content and evidence about nursing issues and thereby promoting critical thinking. Debate has been defined as argument for the purpose of persuading the audience to accept a clearly identified position. Carolyn included a formal debate when she developed Nursing 609, Advanced Trends and Issues, in a course over 6 years ago. So since that time, over 30 sections of students have participated. And we call a section a class, and a class can be anywhere from, oh, I would say 14 to 20 students. I was assigned 609 in the fall of 2009, and I began prep because I didn't have a lot of background in debate, and I was a little anxious about that assignment. There was no research literature to be found about online debating. I was impressed with the student learning and feedback that I was getting as I progressed through the course. So I contacted Dr. Carolyn Park, who was on sabbatical at the time, in November and said, you know, we really need to do a study about this because there's nothing in the literature. So we developed a research plan, we got approval in December and funding in March of 10. Dr. Kim Munich, who teaches with us in the graduate program, joined the team in February of 2010, and she teaches in this course and has for a number of years. In terms of definitions, debate, we're taking the Lowenstein and Bradshaw definition, which is argument for the purpose of persuading the audience to accept a clearly defined, identified position. Formal debate usually involves a team, two teams of three, debating in real time. There's scores given for inherency, solvency, topicality, harms, and significance. Modified formal debate, however, is outlined under the debate protocol that follows. And this was modified by Carolyn to fit the online situation and worked very well. The emphasis is not on winning. We don't give points. We do give marks for the assignments, but each presenter is marked individually and confidentially, so the other presenter doesn't know what each presenter got in that assignment unless they share it themselves. Emphasis is on thorough coverage of the issue and class engagement in the debate. So in terms of the debate protocol that's embedded in this course, students are asked to choose three of 25 debate issue topics. And let me mention here that this is a paced online graduate level course, just so that you're aware that the pacing aspect really was critical for the debate piece to be of any feasibility. Example topics included such things as that capital that the Canadian Health Act should fund harm reduction programs, that RNs should be credentialed in their specialty, that Canada should support physician assistants and nurse practitioner roles, that the Canada Health Act should include coverage for complementary therapies, that hospitals should ensure all RN staffing, and that nursing faculty must participate in relevant clinical practice. These are just some of the topics that were debated. Students were free to suggest other issues, and this has happened definitely in many of the classes. So faculty then match and randomly assign students to the pro or con side. It's a real puzzle. It takes about a couple of days to do, looking at what all their first three choices are and their availability, so that you can match it up as best as you can. Students choose their preferred dates for the presentation, and prior to the debate starting, they explore logical fallacies. The debates start around week five, give or take a week, and they occur over a one-week period. So their opening arguments are posted on day one. 2 days later, they post a rebuttal. Then the class is able to provide comments and feedback for 3 to 4 days. And then debaters post their conclusions. Between day one and day three, the class is quiet. They cannot enter into any discussion. In terms of a literature review to inform our study, there was, as I mentioned, there was very little about online debating, but there was information about debating activities in the classroom and debating outcomes in the classroom, and I'll briefly go through these. In a discussion paper, Candela, Michael, and Mitchell outlined debate activities. The fact that you have active involvement in examining personal views on an issue. You incorporate pertinent concepts and principles. You have to weigh various aspects of the issue, and you search for supporting evidence, and you collate information into an articulate, persuasive argument. Debating can increase nursing student comfort levels in addressing groups, allow for the expression of professional opinions, and foster communication skills. It can promote development of critical thinking skills and promote recognition and appreciation of contextual complexities. In terms of online debating, I was only able to find two studies that perhaps alluded to this. Critical thinking in online group discussion, termed being cognitively present, has three levels of participation associated with a triggering event, such as when a problem is identified. And that's our own Terry Anderson with his colleagues who published that paper. This triggering event leads to exploration, then integration, and lastly, resolution at the highest level. Park, and this is our own Carolyn, who's online, found higher levels of cognitive presence in master's students based on online debate discussions as a triggering event than did others investigating less structured online discussion. So was it the debating that made the difference? So the purpose of our study was to understand what modified formal debating brings to graduate education. So what are the student outcomes? For the first stage of our research, we used qualitative descriptive approach to reveal their perceptions about engaging in debates to determine the outcomes. This is what we're reporting today. Following REB approval, participants were recruited from 3 classes by email by Dr. Park, who had not taught any of these students because she was on sabbatical. She stripped identifiers from self-evaluations and from the wrap-up fora, which comprised the phase one data. Rebecca House then stripped identifiers from all the discussion postings, which were part of phase one and are the phase two data. The sample included 24 of 48 students from all 3 sections, so 50%, which is a pretty good response rate. Actually, it's an excellent response rate. We open-coded data separately in Winnipeg, Edmonton, and Vancouver and communicated our findings and rationale initially via Skype. We met face-to-face for 2 days in April 2010 to further analyze and categorize our findings. Then we met 1 afternoon in May prior to presenting at a conference. Since then, Kim and I have met face-to-face for 3 days, and all of us have met on Skype as well as via email. In terms of elements of rigor that were important to always keep under consideration, openness, responsivity, honesty, respectfulness, attention to detail. We had to be able to relinquish, and this turned into a bit of a challenge because both Carolyn and Kim have previous experience and research in this, in the educational field, and so they came bringing a lot of knowledge about different theories with them. I was the outsider. My background was not the education theory, and so it really helped us to stay honest and responsive, because we were able to play off each other and our expertise. The decision trail was documented. Again, this was more difficult because we were each having to have our own decision trail and then a decision trail for the group. Data influence verification strategies used for methodological coherence, though some difficulties with the fact that the data existed a priori. And we're really experiencing that now because I'm looking at a process, or we're looking at a process in our phase two, and process should include theoretical sampling, which in part means going out there and checking new participants to affirm whether your analysis is on the right track, and we're not able to do that. So it's one of the shortcomings. But the sample was appropriate in terms of our phase one. In terms of findings, all codes were collapsed under 5 categories that encompass the student outcomes: risk-taking, defense of a position, coverage of all aspects, skill and knowledge transfer, and critical thinking. And for each category, we identified the factors that the students described which supported them in achieving these outcomes, calling them the influencing factors. These categories and influencing factors are not mutually exclusive and are interconnected. Our findings indicated that participants took on the assigned risk of defending a proposition in public, some tentatively at first, but all were very engaged by the time they began their debate. They appreciated both sides of the argument and investigated all aspects. They took a stand and defended that stand and put themselves out there. They used their new knowledge of debating in their work and personal lives, and they provided compelling evidence of critical thinking throughout. In terms of risk-taking, the risk is in representing one side of an issue in a public forum. Many students reported angst, anxiety, intimidation, panic, skepticism, worry, and disappointment at not getting the side of the debate that they wanted. Others expressed excitement in anticipation of the challenge. Influencing factors were that the risk is in representing one side of an issue in a public forum, is previous debate experience, so some did have previous experience, and so the risk seemed to be less. The fact that it was an asynchronous online environment was extremely important in this entire risk-taking aspect, because they had time to formulate their ideas and thoughts. They had time to edit. They had time to reflect. And I think this has probably resulted in students engaging even more than they would in a debate were it the normal formal debate in a classroom setting. In fact, I think more was learned and more was gained by the fact that they could engage in the asynchronous online status. One of the aspects that influenced the risk-taking was their value alignment. They had to align their values with the position they were taking. And if they were given the position that they really felt at the outset, it was easier to take the risk. If they didn't, it was much harder to take the risk. Faculty and peer support at the very beginning were very important, and especially the peer support. In terms of the debate experience, previous debate experience is an obvious influencing factor. Viewing the movie The Debaters was really valid for them. This was in the course. It was something that was there that Carolyn had put into the course, and it's something every student found extremely valuable. The Debaters is a movie. Oh gosh, I can't remember who the stars are right now, but it's based on a real experience that occurred in southern states where a group of students who were considered to be less, certainly the underdogs, won a debate, and it showed how they did it. And of course, it was a typical formal debate. There was winners and losers, and there was a team. It's an excellent, excellent movie. But the students found that it really did set them up well.
Is that in any video store?
Yes, you can. It's apparently some video stores are now. It's an old video, so they're putting it on CD. But it's excellent. Yeah. Exploring Debate Central online was really good, and this is embedded in the course, and there is everything you want to know about debating on Debate Central online. Would everyone have heard his question? Oh, I'm sorry. I was asked about whether you could get the movie The Debaters at a video store, and yes, you can. Denzel Washington is who it is, I think.
If you want to read.
Oh.
Do you want to read it?
I'll read. You go ahead.
Carolyn, for those in the room, Carolyn Park notes that it was directed by Denzel Washington, starring Denzel Washington, Nate Parker, Jumi Smollett, and it's a drama based on the true story of Elvin B. Tolson, a professor at Wiley College, Texas, in 1935.
Wow, you've got that right on your fingers, Carolyn. That's great. Thank you. Okay, in terms of the asynchronous online status, I didn't mention the other aspect, the online piece, where the public is invisible, and it's less intimidating to be having a discussion with fellow classmates when you don't have to stand in front of them and see the whites of their eyes. And I certainly know that in terms of presentations. It's definitely easier if you're just online. In terms of value alignment, those assigned to the side of choice have much less angst at the beginning, as I mentioned. But this is before you understand that in your debate you have to know your opponent's side as well as your own. One student described feeling sorry for an opponent who had the con side of the argument, but she later realized that it was difficult for her as well. In terms of time available, they had 2 days to compose and post their rebuttals, and then the rest of the class jumped in and they had time to formulate their ideas and make a posting. At the end of the week, the debaters were able to post their concluding remarks. Faculty and peer support, students wrote of seeking and receiving support from faculty and classmates to better understand the process of debating and the expectations. There was some peer support among students who had made a connection talking about their topic. And there was support by nurses, by students who went to their colleagues at work to get additional information to support their debate. And we have evidence of that in our data. In terms of defense of the position, students had to defend the position by gathering evidence in support of it, presenting that information, and clearly and concisely in an interesting and or creative professional format. And this is a quote. Everything in italics is a quote. In reviewing the literature early, I had numerous lenses to choose from my podium position. In keeping with the structure for a debate, I chose 3 main propositions to defend. My strategy was to temper my opponent's potential arguments by presenting credible evidence. Humor was also used to lighten a heavy topic and inject some fun into our learning. I used humorous cartoons and video to accent the points that I was defending. And another student, the fact that I was randomly assigned to pro-mandatory flu was a leap for me personally to defend, but a great learning activity. The rebuttal was fun for me because he got to defend your reasoning for your side. In terms of the influencing factors for defense of a position, it was the faculty stage setting, evidentiary support, peer support, debating skills, and time. Faculty stage setting had to do with the fact that we had organized the way that this had to be presented and people followed those rules. My professor provided excellent justification for participating in debate on either side of an argument. It suddenly all came together. This assignment wasn't about debating, it was about developing critical analysis and research skills. Debating forces one to look at all the facts surrounding an issue, whether supportive or not. She also pointed out that considering all the facts helps to remove the passion from an argument, thereby allowing one to think more clearly. Evidentiary support. Our introductory, rebuttal, and concluding remarks were grounded in evidence, as supported by our reference lists, which were inclusive of peer-reviewed journals, current national experts in the field of immunization, and also local editorials to reflect evidence in both trends and issues. Sometimes I get a little blown away by what these guys are saying. Debating and PowerPoint skills. I appreciated the opportunity I had to practice my debating skills, and I recognize that this exercise has solidified and enhanced my critical thinking skills. It has allowed me to practice some new skills and approaches, and to recognize some tactics others may use in debate, enhancing my ability to critically analyze debate content. There were students who had never used PowerPoint before, and so that was an additional challenge for those students. But they all stepped up to the plate and did a great job. In terms of time, we've already discussed that. In terms of coverage of all aspects, debaters looked at all aspects of an issue. They and their classmates were informed by the literature, class member discussions, their own experiences, and their coworkers. In terms of classmates, my arguments could have delved sooner into concepts of human rights, such as beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy, and justice, as these concepts came to light during the classmate discussion. For those who disputed my arguments, thank you. I found I needed to really pay deliberate attention to this feedback. This is where the greatest learning was for me. It's always so easy to only select out, either consciously or unconsciously, feedback that supports your debate position. This feedback uncovered my blind spots. From colleagues, the years of clinical experience in a variety of practice environments and management expertise provided very thought-provoking discussions at work. I enjoyed discussing with colleagues in the lunchroom and received a variety of input from different backgrounds, the finance manager, the client services director, and the director for labor relations. So this learning is going far beyond the class. In terms of influencing factors for coverage of all aspects, was basically the course expectations that everybody had to engage. Everyone had to do a posting, one posting at least to the pro, one posting at least to the con. And I can't think of ever when they just did one posting. It was absolutely amazing the amount of discussion that occurred. In terms of relevance of the topic, they found that the topics were very relevant to their practice, and we keep updating those topics yearly so that they remain relevant. In terms of their previous experience, they really connected it to their previous experience to make it meaningful to them and to illustrate to people in the discussion and in the debate what they meant by whatever point they were making. Time always was an influencing factor. And the fourth category, skill and knowledge transfer. We've already seen evidence of that in some of the quotes that I've already included. They reported using their new skill and knowledge about debating and about issues in their work and personal lives. Related to risk-taking, some reported that they chose to take on the risk of arguing their side of an issue in real-life situations using skills learned during the course. My husband wants me to stop identifying all of his fallacious arguments. Another student wrote of how she finally could tackle arguments with her teenagers who always had her flummoxed previously. Interestingly, I utilized some debate lingo and strategies at work to defend a student. I definitely learned a lot about inductive fallacies, which are numerous. Just when you think you have a fact, it's often a fallacy. I will be more comfortable defending my case when I need to fight my cause. Related to sharing knowledge of issues, the information from the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario about best practice guidelines for developing and sustaining effective staffing and workload practices was new to me, and I have shared this with nurse manager colleagues. Related to debating, being able to articulate a position about critical reviews of patient death in a constructive and professional way was very helpful in my role, and I've learned skills in this course that will be helpful in the future as I continue to negotiate with this service. The responsible service has been able in the past to put forward personal agenda items as the cause of these deaths. So the impact is really quite remarkable. This is a different color in my presentation than it is. Whoa!
St. Patrick's.
It got changed a little bit. Anyway, in terms of covering of all aspects, skill, confidence, and knowledge. In terms of the skill of debating and arguing to influence other, confidence in their skills, and the knowledge transfer, the knowledge integration, the depth of knowledge that they took away from the course that that they then applied. The final aspect of the outcome was critical thinking, and it permeated everything, and it was influenced by each of the other outcomes. So, lastly, this writer utilized critical thinking to link the research to show how complementary therapies could be integrated into the healthcare system. I think I've read that already. And finally, your closing statement is the most convincing, that to suggest that the only way a faculty member can maintain competency is through clinical practice undermines the very principles that they are teaching to acquire reflective, critical thinking, and self-evaluation skills in order to direct their own practices they need. So if you remember what we talked about in terms of what critical thinking was, very briefly I mentioned it in the literature review, they're showing strong evidence of making connections and challenging and going beyond and applying it in practice. This is one of the discussion postings that I thought was provided great evidence of critical thinking, although most of them did. I agree with you, Zena. Zena was the name for the person who for a person who was not part of the study, so Zena could be anybody. I agree with you, Zena, that mandatory flu vaccination for nurses is a troubling thought. I personally believe that getting the vaccination is the right thing to do, but it remains questionable as to who a mandatory policy would really serve. As Regina indicated, a parallel but reverse type of case exists with respect to the safety initiatives in healthcare that have become so popular in recent years. Not many would argue against the importance of continuously improving safety in healthcare settings. But I have to question the way that safety has been co-modified by consultant groups as something an organization can opt into with the right motto, philosophy, or strategy. I believe that professional healthcare is about much more than that. Safety has always been an integral part of nursing, and I do not think that quality nursing care should be reduced to little more than safe nursing care, and she provides a reference for that position. Similarly, vaccines are going to benefit most healthcare workers, but as long as there is any known level of risk to even one worker who receives the vaccine, then making it mandatory is just the wrong way to do the right thing. In terms of influencing factors for critical thinking, it's all of the previous categories: risk-taking, defense of the position, coverage of all aspects, and skill and knowledge transfer. Those categories together influence the development and promotion of even greater thinking, critical thinking skills than the students came with. In terms of discussion, after we had done our analysis, Carolyn found a 2004 paper that was about online debate that had not shown up in our initial lit search, and it's by AU's own Cam Jugdev and Carrie Markowski with Thomas Mengel. It was published, as I noted, there in 2004. Their findings reported supported ours in terms of student response to the debate. It was very positive. Their students responded very positively to it. In terms of coverage of all aspects, resulting in some students changing their initial position. And they discussed the need for clear instructions up front, which was a component of our course. Their debate was a group debate. They had students in groups of four or five, I believe. And so there was more work among the group that did not have to occur with our protocol for doing the debate. Generally accepted characteristic of critical thinking includes the ability to reason, research, analyze, infer, and modify positions based on new evidence and to make informed decisions. You can see that was in evidence, certainly, with what I've shown you to date. Linderman and McAfee identified six critical thinking abilities: identifying possibilities, innovations, formulating and analyzing arguments, constructing meaning, using knowledge as context, negotiating, and critically reflecting on own thoughts and actions. Again, findings that we came up with in our study as well. Our findings also align with Perry's seminal 1970 work discussing the third and fourth stages of the development of human thought and knowing processes. The third stage, the stage of relativism, the individual develops the ability to form opinions and values based on weighing information in situations. The fourth stage, the stage of commitment, the individual comes to truth after evaluating information from multiple sources and integrating this with what is known. Debating to promote critical thinking can be most beneficial with students who have reached the third and fourth stages, and we certainly saw evidence of that. And the value of that in graduate education at the very least, if not in undergraduate education. So in conclusion, in response to the question, does formal student debating work online? It certainly does, resulting in risk-taking, defense of a position, coverage of all aspects, skill and knowledge transfer, all of which influence the development of even greater thinking, critical thinking skills than the students came with. I'd like to read one posting by a student. Actually, it was in their self-evaluation as a final statement to my presentation. Contrary to my classmates, I was actually looking forward to this assignment because I saw it as something other than a 15-page essay. I also thought it would be easy to put together in a PowerPoint, since I've been using PowerPoint since I started at AU. Well, was I surprised. When the first debate started and I realized all the research and reflection that goes into preparing an online debate, I knew it wasn't going to be easy. I felt panicked because I had lots of work to do to present a strong debate. I was disappointed that I had to wait until the middle of November before presenting. Because the presentations were so well done, I felt the bar was set very high. I didn't feel I could do it. I felt lots of fear and anxiety as I prepared my debate. After reading the debate links and reading the classmates' presentations, I got even more stressed because I didn't know where to start or what to start with. Since so many classmates have presented interesting angles and strategies to their presentations, I didn't want to copy someone else's debate, so I struggled to be original. As I posted my debate, I felt relieved that part of the work was done. However, I feared what my classmates would ask or comment on. Preparing for the rebuttal was very stressful since I waited till the last minute to prepare because of work pressures. Bev really gave me challenging arguments to rebut. I believe the rebuttal was my biggest learning curve. I enjoyed receiving the feedback afterwards since it actually gave me some ammunition for my closing arguments, and that feedback was from the class members. It was interesting to find out how everyone felt about the topic and where they stood. Completing the self-evaluation, which is what I'm reading from, was something that I really enjoyed. I teach my students to complete journals and self-reflections. I actually had to practice what I preach. Self-evaluation should be done after every assignment. Interestingly, I utilized some debate lingo and strategies to defend a student, and I've already taken this snippet and used it illustrating a previous category. So overall, debating was an effective learning strategy. As nurses need to be able to defend and advocate for our patients, or in my case, for our students, having a well-prepared defense with facts and supporting data definitely demonstrates professionalism and credibility. I have a couple of pages of reference that support the discussion and lit review, and I'm welcoming any questions that anyone may have. Thank you. Oh.
It sounds like a pedagogically very effective strategy that you guys are doing in your 609 class.
Well, I've been teaching for over 30 years, and I've never seen anything quite like the learning that has occurred with this. And I think it would do us well to incorporate this whenever we can. And I've certainly thought long and hard about how could you do this in undergraduate where you don't have a paced environment. And I have ideas if anybody wants to hear them.
We have a couple of questions online, and unfortunately Carolyn has got some bad bandwidth and she keeps dropping in and out of the session. But John has a question. I'll just read it out for those in the room. Having followed the formal process, was there an increase or decrease perceptible in social discussions or other forms of engagement in the class? And then Cheryl has a question as well. I'll give Cheryl the mic in a moment.
Hi, John. I would expect that one from you. Absolutely, there was an increase, and that's what we will be covering in our second phase, because we are looking at the process that occurs and looking at from beginning to end. It was a function of them getting comfortable with each other, a huge function of the safety they felt by virtue of the respect that all students showed for every debater's presentation. And obviously there was a range in abilities in PowerPoint and in debating, but the respectfulness that all students showed is one of the pieces that comes out in our secondary our analysis during the second phase, and we're calling it peer support at this stage.
John adds as well that it seems like a nice way to go through Gilly Simon's five stages.
Now maybe Maybe Kim and Carolyn know those stages, but this is new to me, so I'm going to have to look those up so that I can reflect on them and see how, in our discussion, how we connect with those.
I'm going to give Cheryl the opportunity to grab the mic and ask her question.
Hi. Virginia, I don't know if you know, but I've been talking with Carolyn Park and Cam Jugdev about debating. And one issue that came up was, and I'd like your opinion on this, do you think that students who ended up arguing the side that they didn't want to defend, in the end, believed in their own arguments, even if they didn't in the beginning?
Thank you, Cheryl. That's a great question. And I can speak from personal experience. I have twice engaged in debate because a student dropped out and there was a student without anyone to debate with. Both times I've given myself the what I would call the con, and it wasn't my position originally. And it's amazing how impassioned I got with my position. However, in the final analysis, for one of them, I personally changed my position. For the other, I didn't change my position, but I was blown away by the arguments presented by my my partner, and went away with a lot more knowledge about how to be firm in my position and how perhaps I could adjust my position somewhat to include some of the aspects that other individual presented. I would say that there was a few students who changed their position, but definitely not all. The other thing I'd like to add is that what we have been talking about when we talk about outcomes, and it isn't really reflected here, Kim and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago when we met, is that there isn't really a wrong or right to these positions. And so students come out with an amalgam of both sides, and they work it for how it fits in their practice, their life. So you end up with grayness, actually, when you might start out with black and white. And we don't see that as a negative. We see that as a very strong positive, because that is, in effect, what most of us think life is like.
Rick Kenny has a question, and I'm going to pass off the mic to him.
Hi, folks. Thanks very much for the very interesting presentation. I came in not really expecting a research presentation, but that was an added bonus. It's funny that Carolyn and I have been working together on mobile learning for the past 4 years and never discussed this once. I just sort of as a quick aside, I've tried online debates a couple of times in Masters of Distance Ed courses, particularly Trends and Issues in Instructional Design. And then now we're trying it again this winter in our learning theory course. I'm taking sort of a different tactic in that this is just a single debate on one topic. And I asked the students to form up into a affirmative, and when I used to found the term negative team online, but they're not real happy with the word negative, so I have to come up with a different term. But we had teams of four or five, maybe as much as six, and I had asked them to do an initial position and two rebuttals followed by discussion, but I'm finding that the discussion much doesn't happen. We also have I have tried it with a judging team that sort of passed judgment in the end. So I'm wondering if a couple of things. I was wondering if you've thought about doing this in terms of thinking about this sort of feeling comfortable and so on. If you've thought about doing this as group activities, collaborative group activities instead, and if you thought about having someone other than the judging team, or sorry, the debate teams themselves come up with the last position. So I will stop there. Also, I'm hoping that you're going to post this paper somewhere, or I'd love to read your protocol again, and your, especially all the instructions and guidance you've given to your students. Meaning, I want to pilfer from it. Over.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for your comments and questions. I'd be happy to send you the protocol. I've just revised the course and have it all neat and tidy, and can send that along to you. As far as group, in terms of this course, no. We have so many issues. That is, the content in the course about issues comes from the debates. We don't have a textbook about issues. We have no other way that we present the issues except through the debate. So if we did group, we wouldn't be able to cover as many issues. Plus, by doing it the way we do it, we get such deep engagement from each student into it, and the other students learn it equally as well. So you cover more this way, I think. However, that said, I know that there's some faculty looking at the debate process for other courses in our program. We do a lot of group work in other courses, and that comes with its own baggage, and I just leave it to other instructors to consider whether they would want to do it group or the way we do it. And I think the critical piece is whether you're covering a lot of material through your debate, and also whether you have a lot of other group activities that they are engaged in and they don't need another group activity. Did I cover everything?
Well, we have a couple of comments just to John was, I think, referring to Salmon's five-stage model and indicated it's a research-based scaffolded way to move from simple social familiarity to critical thinking and construction. And Kim made the comment again in relation to the sort of discussion that came after that. Some of mine, her students, didn't change their minds and can take the side they debated. However, they stated they gained a better understanding of the other side so they could defend in real life. Yeah. And I believe that Linda has a question, and John does as well, but we'll get to Linda if you want to grab the mic, Linda. Linda, we couldn't hear anything on our side. I don't know if any of the other attendees could hear something, but do you want to try again? And if it's not working, maybe you could type your question. And while you're doing that, we'll move on to John. So I'll give you the mic one more time, or at least try that. Yeah, I'm afraid that we couldn't hear you, Linda. So we'll... yes, there's still a problem, so we'll go back to John's question and give you a chance to type that in. And John asked, did you consider using alternative debate forms? And if so, what made you decide to use this particular style of formal debate? I'm particularly interested because I've prepared a debate-oriented course that uses several different forms, pyramid debates, Oxford debates, free-for-alls, team debates, small group, fishbowls, including one similar to this in style and purpose. So,
is Carolyn online? Because she is the one who organized and designed the course, and we've been following the way she's done it, I believe, most of the time with small modifications that each professor has used with their class. Is she there?
Unfortunately, Caroline is on her off bandwidth.
So, John, I can't actually say how she came to this. I think it was a brilliant idea, and I've told her so. I think my point that we have to cover content. This was a way of engaging the students in not only covering the content, but presenting the content. I don't get involved as a professor in their discussion almost at all. I read it. There's I just don't need to. They are covering it. They they are so powerful in what they come across with in their discussion as well as in the presentations. So I think that might have been the thinking behind it, is that we have this content that needs to be covered in this course. It's a trends and issues course. This isn't their only assignment. They have to write a big trends paper and do an annotated bibliography, et cetera, et cetera. It's a heavy, heavy marking course, to say the least. But I think that that's probably why, and we needed to put parameters on it so that I think she chose the week. I can't say why she chose the week, but it works really well, both for professors as well as for the students. And Kim, if you can shed any light on it, because you've been teaching this course a lot longer than me.
While Kim might be composing her response, Linda writes, thanks, Virginia, for an interesting presentation. It's an interesting topic for us on the right side because very often we discuss CT skills as students are developing them in their writing. I'm wondering what formal preparation your students had in CT skills prior to the debates and what impact you think this preparation might have had.
Actually, Linda, there was no formal discussion of critical thinking skills at all. These are graduate level students. Critical thinking, as you know, I believe your background's nursing. I mean, it's pounded into us in undergrad. So we took it as a given that they came with a degree of this, but we certainly saw we saw change, and we saw that by the end they were really integrating more, challenging more, and wanting to support whatever their opinions had been better. So would it have helped? I'm trying to think of students that one might consider a little bit weaker. I'm not sure, Linda. That's a good point. Maybe having a website that they could go to, because we have lots of links for them to do self-study on aspects of the course that they don't personally know about, like the Debate Central. So perhaps we could include something like that, so that those students who perhaps thought they didn't have effective critical thinking skills or highly developed could have gone there. However, that said, again, I have to go back to, you can't nurse very long and not be a critical thinker. So they have been developing these skills through practice as well. It's the piece about arguing that nurses tend not to be very good at. We cave or we do the nice thing. We are not effective arguers. And that's the piece that I think they really get from this. Get out there, take the risk, and learn how to be to defend your position and not to be emotional. Because you may often hear way back when they used to interview nurses about the shortages in healthcare, and they'd always say, well, someone's going to die. You know, well, that's such an emotional and response that goes way beyond what is necessary to provide a logical, informed, impassioned argument. And I think that's what a lot of students took from this. They can critically think, but how to demonstrate that critical thinking.
John just adds, again, to earlier comments, he gets around the marking load by only marking reflections on collated contributions. The idea is to avoid assessing debate directly. I think that's what you had mentioned as well. And it's tricky because it's assessing a changing process, not a product. And And Cheryl says, it sounds like learning about fallacies was helpful to students. Mm-hmm. And John talks about preparation. Might be worth looking at the salmon. This course seems very good for stages 2 and 5, but worth considering 1 and 2, stages 1 and 2. The reference to that is in here, but I'm sure they would pass it on, or yeah. It looks like Kim has picked it up. And Kim also responds to the format question. The format for the debate seems to have evolved through student evaluation, as far as I know, but Carolyn would be the best person to answer. Initially, in previous courses, students chose the format they wanted to use, but this one became the most effective, and her mic is not working either. Thanks from Linda, and John clarifies the changing process being the debate, reflection are the finished object or the finished product. So I'll let you comment on all that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if Kim, I'm sure you'll email me that reference. Rick, if you can send me an email and I can get back to you about the protocol. John, in terms of marking, I mark how they PowerPoint, how they do PowerPoints too. I think I need to move beyond that because it's very time consuming. I mark grammar and things like that. But yes, I'm not, they all do, there's very few who don't do well. There have been some who have not passed the assignment for various reasons, but not many at all. Because, of course, by the time you get to master's level, you're hoping that that piece isn't a part of what you have to deal with. Let's see, what else was there? I don't know that I mentioned that there's three components to the debate assignment, and it's worth 45 marks. The first component is the actual debate, the PowerPoints that you present, the three, over the week-long period, and how you respond to the feedback that you're given in the discussion. That's another piece, that's a part of it. And there's also 10% given for the self-reflection, where you talk about lessons learned, what did you think, what would you do differently next time, etc. And that's 10%. So I guess how that all adds up is 25% for the three debates. It's a heavy course because, as I said, then we have another paper that is major that has an annotated bib and all of that.
Rick also wants to know your email address. I think it's at Virginia.
At Athabasca.
Okay. I'll send
Virginia at athabascau.ca.
And then Rick also adds that his marking protocol involves a peer evaluation rating and a participation mark adding up to about 10%. He also doesn't mark the actual debate. And John comments that your process is quite a marking load.
Oh, yeah.
And it's pretty active out there online. We'll give a chance for the people in the room to ask questions.
Yeah, Mark here. It sounds to me like you did have a kind of a mini logic course at the beginning, right?
What we had was a little, there was an assignment. I've handled it in this particular, okay, this data is based on three classes, one of them Kim's, one of them mine, and one of them our other professors. In my class, there is an assignment that's you don't have to do. It's a self-assignment. And I was new to the course, so I made them do it and marked it. And they had to get into the fallacies, and they really got into them. The second time I taught this that is not part of this data, I didn't make it a requirement. I left them do it. They didn't do the debate as knowledgeably as they did when they did the assignment. I'm not sure about Kim if she, it's not a requirement. I just say post it. So I guess you could say that's a requirement. It doesn't get any marks. It's just all part of their discussion mark. It was very time consuming. So I've since done it a little differently where I have them post it and they mark it for each other. But yes, there is that piece. It's a question that is asked, and there is a link to fallacies, and I have added a few more links there since then about logical fallacies. But it doesn't talk about critical thinking. It's more about the fallacies piece, that aspect of it, and how to defend, how to point out a fallacy and what type of fallacy it is.
Are there any other questions, comments from our Illuminate crowd?
Well, thank you all. I really enjoyed your questions and feedback, and I've got some interesting reading to do.
And thank you for a very kind of inspiring look at making graduate teaching more effective. That might also be useful at the undergrad level. So thanks a lot.
Maybe you could speak to that, actually, about your thoughts about continuous individualized study, continuous enrollment. I mean, I have a discussion forum in my Canadian politics course, and it has enough students that that forum sort of works. But what were your thoughts about that?
Well, probably the way you are doing that is similar to what I was thinking. Every September, that's our biggest dump of students. So we have a cohort that starts for a little period of time. And I thought if we had two assignments in whatever course there is, one that would be a paper you do by yourself, the other that would be you could do this optional assignment instead of the paper, engage in debate, and all of those who want to do it, then you deal with them the way we deal with it, and you could pair them up, and because they don't have to work with each other. You can pair them up, and you could have maybe a two-month period where you have debates occurring that people can join into or not. And so you'd have to ask up front or within the first 3-4 weeks who might be interested in that. And I think it could work for a cohort of students that are self-paced. And for the rest of the course, they could do it their own way. But I think for this, you could have a few that might agree to do it. And I think if you even had 10 to 16, you would get benefit out of it. And it would have to be, and you might do it as a group, but I see that you could cover a few topics by having the two people. That's what I was thinking. I certainly see it in political science. My heavens, that could be really valuable to them. And then they could opt one way or the other. And then they could still take their 6 months if they need it, but for a couple of months they pace themselves about that assignment. I want to say in closing that I want to raise a glass in toast to Carolyn for doing this, and it's the best kept secret until until I got involved with it and started yelling from the sidelines how important this was. I didn't even really know about this, and so she deserves a real round of applause for considering it way back in 2003, 2004, and running with it.
Good work. Thanks.
Virtual applause from all.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. We're going to close off the session. Thanks for attending. Bye now.